open things up for any questions people might have. Yes.
I just wondered if your monastery and if Metamethasol and Forest Lab experiences these large, from the Western view,
large and rather garish looking Buddhas, sort of fake gold or something. And I was just wondering, you know, I don't know. It seems like neon versus, you know, something. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious if you had any reflections about that. It's my problem, I know, but. Right.
Well, it's the main Buddha image at Abhayagiri is actually matte black. Up on the hill, there's a golden, a kind of a glistening golden one up on the hill. The one in the main shrine room is a matte black one. But we chose that mainly because people in the West don't like, you know, flashy golden images. The one on the hillside, we were given that arrived as is, and. Also, actually, one that was offered to us, made for us, that's up in the forest. When it was first done, they had it ready. It was done with a kind of dark brown, kind of matte finish. And then what happened was that a cat in the warehouse peed on it. And so that the one of the workers at the foundry then, it just was waiting for shipment. It was already to come to America. So then he tried to clean it up, and then the cleaning agent to get the cat pee off then started to take off the surface. And he thought, oh dear, well, I better use something else to get that off. And that made it even worse. Started actually sort of eroding the whole surface. So by the time, he was having a complete panic by this time, and anyway, they looked at it, and the foundryman thought, well, we can't really rescue it with this current surface, but what we could do is we can patch it and then cover the whole thing with gold. And so then they wrote to us. Well, our friend in Thailand who was looking after this then. Wrote to us and told us what was happening, and then we just said, sorry, gold is totally unacceptable. Those people in the West don't like flashy gold images. No, sorry, you know, it just can't. You know, that's not okay. And anyway, things came together, and they did another casting, which was it was an occasion. Ajahn Pasana, the other co-abbot, could be there. Anyway, it all turned out very well. We got our desired image, the nice dark brown one. But it was precisely because of no, you can't have a flashy golden image. We've got one of those already. Just one is enough. Because, you know, people in the West don't like that. In Asia, that's generally much more appealing. And they say, why do you want such a dull one? That's not beautiful. That's the way. So the idea of what is beautiful and what is not beautiful.
Were you there when, was it Ringu Rinpoche, Sophie's younger brother?
Mingyu.
Yeah, he was looking at our image and he was like, wow, it's so lifelike.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, after all the Tibetan images.
Yeah. It looked lifelike.
The
one? No, the black one. Because compared to the Tibetan ones, that simple black one. And the one we have in the main shrine room is modeled on the Borobudur Buddha images. Very simple. So a lot of it's to do with perception. The one that Tanjeff has, that I think they built the shrine room around it. It was
right.
So huge,
yeah.
But that was also gifted. And so that you are generally working with differences of perception, and like even the one that we have in the shrine room, the main one we have, but the fellow who was, because you work with a maquette, you know, that when they're making a model for it, and they have it in clay. And then they send you pictures, or you go and visit and look at the maquette, and they say, well, do you want it different? Do you want any kind of changes made to it? And then we would say, no, the cheeks are way too fat. The cheeks need to come down. But the fellow who was offering says, no, it already looks skinny. You know, actually, you know, the cheeks are, they're good. Because he had kind of round cheeks as well. And then says, no, he's like, he looks really fat. No, in the West, people don't like kind of big, fat, round-faced Buddhas. They want to have a Buddha with a nice little trim jaw. And says, no, he looked really skinny. That's like the fasting Buddha before the Enlightenment. You can't have that. And then we say, you know, and the mouth is way too small. Why have you got the mouth so small? No, the mouth is just right. No, the mouth needs to be. No, it's perfect. It's perfect just the way it is. And so it's not like you're both seeing the same thing in a different way. You're actually seeing different things. You know, so sometimes we think we're looking at the same object, but when you really contemplate the nature of perception, it's not the same object. You know, and so then, particularly, you know, here you are in the West, but you're bringing in an Asian oriented or Asian originated system, so that you're having to mesh these different sets of perceptions and different realities. And mostly, what you find when Buddha images start to be made in countries where they come to, then they start to take on the features of the country where they are found. So, like Japanese Buddhas look Japanese, Chinese Buddhas look Chinese, Tibetan Buddhas look Tibetan. The Thai ones actually are unusual because they still have some Indian features. The Thai culture is very, very heavily influenced by Indian, so that you know, Thai Buddha images, they often will. Now this one isn't quite so extreme, but often they'll say, well, you know, the Buddha was Indian, so he has to have a big nose. And so that sometimes Thai Buddha images is sort of the Thai version of what Indians look like. But mostly the Buddha images take on the features of the countries where they're being made. And so that as they make more and more Buddha images in the West, then you can be absolutely sure that the Jesus is, you know, he's from Kansas, you know. Nice blue-eyed boy from Kansas, with blonde hair and fine Caucasian features. I mean, he was a Palestinian, right? Jesus came from Palestine. He was not a blue-eyed blonde. but adopted by the European countries, then, you know, he becomes that. The image gets woven into what is, you know, can be related to by the local community. So I suspect that the more that Buddhism transplants itself into the West, then the number of sparkly golden images will diminish, and the number of soft, muted tones and with more Western type features will emerge. But to an Asian mind, that kind of brightness, it's representing the gloriousness. It's not supposed to be skin color, you know. It's representing a kind of splendor, you know, a gloriousness, and that to have an undecorated Buddha, we think, oh dear, it's wrong, you know. Needs to have some jewels there, or at least sitting on a lotus flower, or, you know, something. Yeah.
Just a little follow-up on that. I have a Buddha that was made for me by my brother, who's a stone carver. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, he died before he could finish the statue. It's maybe 3 feet tall. It's carved out of Pennsylvania limestone. The facial features are mostly finished above the nose. There's a beautiful peacefulness about it. The rest of it is shaped roughly, but it's a body, very... you can see the chisel marks. And a friend of mine, who is actually a Christian minister, looked at it. And I said, "And here's my Buddha. It's out in the yard." And explained why it was unfinished. And she looked at it and she said, "Well, we're all unfinished Buddhas." And I actually think I may like this Buddha better in its unfinished state as representing that.
In Borobudur, which is this huge, it's got the biggest Buddhist shrine in the world, in Java. It's a very interesting symbolism. It was built in about the 7th or 8th century. And the very interesting symbolism that it has, that it starts off in the lower levels. It's like a huge stupa, like a mountain. The lower levels, you have the friezes of the and bas reliefs of the Buddha's previous lives and his life story. And then, as you go up the stupa, then each level has sort of different kinds of representations. So then you have the images of the Buddha's life, and then you get up to a certain level, and it stops going from a square shape to a round shape. The levels are round, and then the Buddha images are then set inside small stupas, and they're set inside, first of all, they're kind of bell-shaped stupas, and then they have holes in the outside. And one level they have square holes, and then the next level up the holes are smaller and they're diamond-shaped. So as you go up, it's kind of harder and harder to see the Buddha, and it's from the sort of very graphic and colorful and lively life stories. Then as you go up the mountain, the Buddha becomes more and more hidden. And so then right at the top you have a huge sort of bell-shaped stupa right at the top, and it's completely sealed, so that as you go up you can see less and less of the Buddha, until finally at the top you can't see him at all. And then when they opened up the stupa when they were doing excavations and restoration in the 60s and 70s, inside the bell-shaped stupa at the top, they found a Buddha image which was unfinished, and you can see it today. It's similar to the one that you have. That the face is there, and then and one arm, but the hand melds into the knee, and then on the left side, and then the part of the left side is unfinished also, and just melts into the living rock, the kind of raw rock. And that when they unearthed it, they thought, well, what happened? Did they run out of money, or couldn't they pay the stone carver to to finish it? But it seems that was that right at the very top, you had not only was the Buddha sort of completely hidden or unformed, but even when that was revealed, it was still sort of moving between formed and unformed, and that it was his own spiritual symbol, its own way. So that using Buddha images and what and the messages they bring to us and the symbols they bring can be many, many faceted. And so that I was really impressed. I thought, oh, that's a really brilliant piece of spiritual iconography. That's really a great idea in terms of bringing a symbol like that, because of the sort of unrepresentability, of the Buddha. And yet and then I found another report that says, well, they say that's what happened, but actually it was just an unfinished Buddha, and that the real one that was in there was made of solid gold and somebody stole it, and then they just put this unfinished one in place so that people would think there was something there. And so I don't know which story is true, but either way, you can, even if it was true that there was a solid gold one that they then took away and replaced, the one of the half-formed Buddha that's hidden away, I feel is actually a very fine symbol in its own right. Even if it wasn't intended, it was just the thieves thought, here, stick this there, Joe, quick, let's make off with the gold one. Yeah.
After the death of the Buddha, wasn't the only thing they really had was stupas, and then it went over to statues? Is that correct?
Originally there was the first shrines were stupas, and a stupa is originally like just a funerary mound. It's where after someone's been cremated, then you put the ashes into a mound, and it would just be a kind of memorial. And so then, actually one of the passages that I will read will be from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha encourages people to pay their respects to stupas. But then it was then by the time of Ashoka and then the great stupa of Amaravati and that era, the Buddha was, they represented the Buddha, but only in symbol, so that never in a human figure. So that if you look at the carvings from the Amaravati stupa, or say from Sanchi, those ancient stupas, you see the Buddha represented by a pair of footprints, or sometimes by the seven-headed naga, or a Bodhi tree, or sometimes an empty chair. And so it's fascinating reading the histories of or the academic papers and correspondence of the early archaeologists in India, because they're thinking, well, it was actually this great stupa. I think there were serpent worshippers, because you see a lot of these big snakes in the carvings, and they don't notice it's not the snake, it's the space under the snake's hood. The Buddha, the sort of non-represented Buddha who's sitting and being protected by Musalinda. Well, no, I think they were tree worshippers, because there's all these tree carvings. It's not the tree, it's the space under the tree where the non-represented Buddha is sitting. So they kept trying to figure out, well, are they tree worshippers? Are they snake worshippers? Are they chair worshippers? You know? Because it's literally like just like a chair sitting there with nobody sitting in it. Do they worship somebody with very, very large feet? You know, from the Buddha footprints. And then took them years to figure it out. These are actually all symbols of the same thing, because once they started to be able to translate the writing, then they could see they were all referring to the same teacher. But they were not using any kind of they deliberately avoided using a human form, and it was the Greek. I think that's being challenged as well now. But historically. In the past, it's been said that it was the Greek influence when Alexander invaded India, and they started using the human form in Gandhara, in the what's now Pakistan, Gandhara, Kashmir, where the Greeks' kingdom there, that they started carving Buddha images. So the first Buddha images look like, he looks like Apollo.
Yes, we heard.
He looks very Grecian, this sort of kind of beautiful hair, kind of hairdo, and his flowing Grecian robes, and so that created the original model for the Buddha Rupa. But I know Tanjef he's unearthed some current academic research where they think that actually there were maybe representations of the Buddha in human form before the Greeks, and certainly in the northern Buddhist tradition that's the case. They say that actually even in the Buddha's lifetime, King Udaina of Kosambi had an image of the Buddha made during his lifetime that the Buddha approved of, and that a copy of that is one of the that was brought back by Huan San in the 7th century. Yeah, that was it.
When the original question was asked, some train of thought occurred to me that I wanted to share in terms of looking the appearance of things and seeing through appearances, and we bring our whole culture with us when we look at something, and that a Westerner, it seems to me, would see a beautiful golden Buddha and have somewhere back in their mental closet thou shalt not have graven images, mm-hmm. from the Old Testament, and would have lay not up treasure in heaven from the New Testament, and a kind of aversion, if finer version of aversion might be triggered, where in other cultures that, you know, it would be a very different thing. All the gold represents splendor or something, but that that the way we approach something is very, as you say, culturally determined, but we're still, you know, going to encounter the aversions and attract. Oh, it's too beautiful. Well, then you shouldn't like it, and whatever.
Well, that leads me very neatly onto the next batch of things I was going to talk about. So, actually, also the original question did too, from because that is often the initial experience is particularly coming out of the Judeo-Christian and then also the sort of American Protestant tradition, you know, don't bow to anybody, and the Judaic tradition also. And then, you know, the whole kind of language of bowing down to golden idols. You know, it would be often the case of, and there was a local American missionary school teacher in northeast Thailand that she would get really frantic when any of her children tried to even make anjali to her. Because you know, in Thailand, that's all the way school children, they say good morning to their teacher. They say, you begin your day bowing to your teacher. She said, don't bow to me! Don't bow to me! You shouldn't bow to anybody! And, yeah, she's a good American Protestant, but trying to do the right thing, with the kids would be like, what? But you're our teacher, you know. We love you. Therefore, if you love me, don't bow to me. Like, what? And she had a really great difficulty trying to come to terms with that. So it's a very common experience to have that, particularly conditioned by out of a sort of Catholic or Jewish or Church of England, you know, the whole sort of Judeo-Christian conditioning of the West, a kind of feeling of having been oppressed by religious systems and told you've got to believe this and this is right and true and so that either having reacting against the whole religiosity in the first place, or even if you're not rejecting that, just you have these kind of encouragements or commands to not bow to golden images or to worship other gods or to relate in these kind of ways is a forbidden element within the tradition, and so that there's often that kind of aversion, negativity, and so that's why in very much in the sort of American Buddhist world, at least in the sort of 70s and 80s, that there was a major theme, at least particularly amongst the sort of Theravada Vipassana type practitioners, of just pushing that all aside, like we don't do that. And if you listen to some of the tapes or read some of the materials out of IMS and Spirit Rock from those times, it was very much, you know, we don't do that. We're not. That's not what we do. We're putting all that behind us. And it was a very kind of funny, painful incident. And actually, it was someone who used to live very near here, Howard Noodleman. He was president of IMW. That was the precursor to Spirit Rock, Insight Meditation West. And he was on a 10-day retreat led by Ajahn Sumedho, and this was at Angela Center. This was in pre-Spirit Rock era. This was back in 1990. And so at the end of this 10-day retreat, he asked if Ajahn Sumedho, well, I've got this film that we made about this new Spirit Rock place that we're opening up, and we want to kind of let people know about it and sort of spread the word. So would it be okay at the end of the retreat if we play this film for people to watch? And Ajahn Sumedho, oh, fine, yes, no problem. So there we all were gathered in the shrine, and they set up the film for us all to look at. And then it starts off with film that's taken from a documentary about Ajahn Chah's monastery, you know, with huge kind of golden Buddhas sitting in the shrine room, everyone bowing in sort of unison down to it, and everyone chanting Yo So Bhagava, and then you get a voiceover from Jack saying, in Asia, in Buddhist practice, there's a big emphasis on, you know, on ritual and ceremony, but what we're trying to do in with Spirit Rock Center is completely different from that. And then he started saying, this is something that we want to sort of leave behind us. And Howard was, Howard had forgotten what the content was. And also part of the irony, brutal irony, was that during the retreat, Howard had started off with a kind of lot of aversion to the chanting and the bowing and all the ceremonies that we had morning and evening. But then about halfway through the retreat, he'd had this transformation go on, and he had this great sort of spiritual opening, and he began to really love all of the devotional side of it and was really looking forward to it and delighting in it, enjoying it. And so he'd had this, and he said that during an interview with Ajahn Sumedho. This is amazing. I am so averse to that. I really hated all of that kind of bowing. You know, I'm a good Jewish boy, and I don't like bowing to anything. And then, you know, suddenly I realized what it all means, and I really wanted to, and I really love it, and that's so great. So then there we were sitting watching the film, and then he sees this, you know, that very ceremonial side being specifically pinpointed and said, you know, that's we're leaving that behind. We're not doing that. That's out of the picture. And he was dying a thousand deaths. He was physically squirming in his seat. Oh God. And yeah, it wasn't that bad really, but it was it wasn't that offensive at all. It was just he had forgotten what was in it, and also in relationship to his own sort of change of heart. As soon as the film finished, I'm terribly sorry, we'll change it, we've got time to edit it, you know. But it was ironic that Jack was actually using film of his own home monastery, Ajahn Chah's monastery, as an example of how not to do it. So it was kind of very ironic kind of irony written in large letters across the screen. So, but it's very normal and natural to have that kind of aversive reaction from our conditioning, because it's oftentimes because of feeling fenced in by our religion or burdened by it or kind of abused by the religious forms. And we want to get rid of that, and so anything that's to do with obeying, you know, a monastic, you know, those Catholic nuns in school, and that I don't want to have anything to do with that. I'm leaving all that behind. I'm rejecting that. And so that it's not an absolutely crucial piece, you know, that people say just pure wisdom, insight, meditation, that's the thing, that we don't need any of that sort of mumbo jumbo, and we can just follow the pure wisdom tradition, and in theory that's true, but it's not always the whole picture. On that same visit, I remember we were at been at a house blessing for a friend of ours, and this house blessing, this is a fellow who is, you know, very committed Buddhist meditator and part of I think he's on the board, the Spirit Rock board, and he had a house blessing, and the house blessing was a combination of Native American Jewish house blessing. It was kind of very neatly done. It was all very beautiful. And then after it was all over, we were standing on the deck, and this other fellow who was there at the gathering said, you know, it's really a shame that there isn't anything in Buddhism, you know, that does the way you can sort of do, you know, blessing a house like this. I mean, it was kind of a lovely ceremony, but it was a shame that it had to be the sort of Jewish Native American mix, and they couldn't have used something Buddhist. Isn't it strange that there isn't anything like that in the Buddhist tradition? And I did a, you know, very theatrical, I'm sorry. Are you joking? Yeah. And he said, well, no, there isn't really. I mean, it's just the meditation and you know, the Dharma teachings, and you know, we don't really have anything like this. I said, you know, you wouldn't believe, you know, how much stuff there is that we can do in this kind of respect. But he was quite sincere. He really didn't realize, because he'd come in through that sort of de-ritualized Vipassana type approach. So it's been interesting since that time to see how things have changed and evolved, and that people have the need for ritual, particularly like births and marriages, deaths and blessing houses and so forth, but also just in terms of a quality that comes together and supports spiritual practice, that people are beginning to see how it works together. And so like a day like today to explore that is really helpful, that you don't have to be superstitious, or you don't have to be in a state of subjection to a ritual that, you know, you've got to get it right, otherwise the earth's going to open up under you, or you're going to get punished and so forth. But there's a purpose and an attitude that we can have to it that actually makes it a very supportive element of our practice. So I thought that I would read this a very interesting little account of this is from John Blofeld's autobiography, or at least an account of his travels in China. And this is where he's visiting the monastery. John Blofeld was an English Buddhist writer of the 50s and 60s, and quite influential in his own day. And he went to visit the... he was a Chinese speaker, he spoke Chinese. And he went to visit the monastery of the Venerable Xu Yun, who was the most eminent Buddhist teacher of modern times in China. And he lived... this is a monk who lived to 120 years old. He was still... if you're familiar with a set of books called Chan and Zen Training, translated by Charles Luke, there's Dharma talks from a retreat that he led in Shanghai at Dragon Flower Monastery when he was 114. A session that he was... So if you're thinking of retiring... And anyway, there's many amazing stories about him, but John Blofeld went to visit him when he was about 100. The present abbot was no other than the Venerable Xu Yun, who was believed to be well over 100 years old, although still able to walk as much as 30 miles a day. True. He was renowned all over China as the greatest living master of Zen, so I was delighted to hear the unexpected news that he just returned after an absence of several months spent in a distant province. Not long after my arrival, I excitedly followed the reverent receiver of guests to pay my respects to this almost mythical personage. I beheld a middle-sized man with a short, wispy beard and remarkably penetrating eyes. He was not precisely youthful-looking, as youthful-looking as I had been led to expect, but had one of those ageless faces not uncommon in China. Nobody could have guessed that he was already a centenarian. Finding myself in his presence, I became virtually tongue-tied and had to rack my brains for something to say, although there was so much that I could profitably have asked him. At last, I managed to ask, "Is this famous monastery purely Zen, Your Reverence?" "Oh yes," he answered, in a surprisingly vigorous voice. "It is a great center of Zen." "So, you do not worship Amida Buddha or keep his statue here?" The question seemed to puzzle him, for he took some time to reply. "But certainly we keep his statue here. Every morning and evening we perform rites before it and repeat the sacred name while circumambulating the altar." Then this monastery is not purely Zen," I persisted, puzzled in my turn. "Why not? Is it like every other Zen it's like every other Zen monastery in China. Why should it be different? Hundreds of years ago there were many sects, but the teachings have long been synthesized, which is as it should be. But if by Zen you mean the practice of Zen meditation, why, that is the very essence of Buddhism. It leads to a direct perception of reality in this life, enabling us to transcend duality and go straight to the one mind. This one mind, otherwise known as our original nature, belongs to everybody and everything. But the method is very hard, hard even for those who practice it day and night for years on end. How many people are prepared even able to do that? The monastery also has to serve the needs of simple people, illiterate people. How many of them would understand if we taught only the highest method? I speak of the farmers on our own land here and of the simple pilgrims who come for the great annual festivals. To them we offer the other way, repetition of the sacred name, which is yet the same way, adapted for simple minds. They believe that by such repetition they will gain the Western paradise and there receive divine teaching from Amida Buddha himself, teaching which will lead them directly to Nirvana. At once, reluctantly and somewhat daringly, I answered, I see, but isn't that kind of, well, sort of, deception? Good, no doubt, but..." I broke off, not so much in confusion as because Venerable Xu Yun was roaring with laughter. "Deception? Deception? Not at all, not a bit, no, of course not. then your reverence, if you too believe in the Western heaven and so on, why do you trouble to teach the much harder road to Zen? I do not understand the distinction you're making. They're identical. But listen, Pooh, Mr. Pooh, you call him Mr. Pooh. Pooh Lowfelt. Listen, Mr. Pooh, Zen manifests self-strength. In Japanese, that's called Jiriki. Amidism manifests other strength. It's called Tariki. You rely on your own efforts, or you rely on the saving power of Amida. Is that right? Yes, but they are, they seem, entirely different from each other. I became aware that some of the other monks were beginning to look at me coldly, as though I was showing unpardonable rudeness in pertinaciously arguing with this renowned scholar and saint. But the master, who was quite unperturbed, seemed to be enjoying himself. "Why insist so much on this difference?" he asked. "You know that in reality there is naught but the one mind. You may choose to regard it as in you or out of you, but in and out have no ultimate significance whatsoever, just as you, Mr. Pooh, and I, an Amida Buddha, have no real separateness. In ordinary life, self is self and another is other. In reality, they are the same. Take Bodhidharma, who sat for 9 years in front of a blank wall. What did he contemplate? What did he see? Nothing but his original self, his true self beyond duality. Thus he saw reality face to face. He was thereby freed from the wheel and entered nirvana, never to be reborn, unless voluntarily as a bodhisattva. Yet, your reverence, I do not think that Bodhidharma spoke of Amida, or am I wrong? True, he did not. But when Farmer Wang comes to me for teaching, am I to speak to him of his original self, or reality, capital R, and so on? What do such terms mean to him? Morning and evening he repeats the sacred name, concentrating on it until he grows oblivious of all else. Even in the fields, as he stoops to tend the rice, he repeats the name. In time, after a month, a year, a decade, a lifetime, or several lifetimes, he achieves such a state of perfect concentration that duality is transcended and he too comes face to face with reality. He calls the power by which he hopes to receive this, to achieve this, Amida. You call it Zen. I may call it original mind. What's the difference? The power he thought was outside himself was inside himself all the time. Deeply struck by this argument and anxious, perhaps, to display my acquaintance with the Zen way of putting things, I exclaimed, I see. Bodhidharma entered the shrine room from the sitting room. Farmer Wang entered it through the kitchen. But they both arrived at the same place. I see. No, answered the Zen master, you do not see. They didn't arrive at any place. They just discovered that there is no place for them to reach. This reply made me feel proud of myself. It seemed I had grasped the point correctly, for the master had condescended to answer with one of those Zen paradoxes which forced the hearer into even deeper understanding. His broad smile was enough to show that he was really satisfied with my reply. After all, I added complacently, it's all just a matter of words. Instead of nodding approvingly, the Venerable Su Yun turned away from me suddenly and began speaking on quite a different subject to one of his disciples. His withdrawal was so pointed that, for a moment, I felt as hurt by a harsh snub. Then I saw the point and almost laughed aloud. Of course, that's it, I said to myself. The significance of that turning away is as clear can be. It means, on the contrary, it's all a matter of no words. Silence. Of course, that was it. I prostrated myself and walked out to find the room allotted to me for the night. So, being a wonderful exposition of the Euro, European-Asian interface. I thought I would share that with you. So that's from John Blofeld's book, The Wheel of Life. So whether Master Su Yun was actually giving him a special teaching on silence, or just thinking, these Farangs, totally deluded. Anyway, we've got to fix that roof. Jody Pilot? So that That I think also in Venerable Master Shuyun's description is extremely helpful, that talking about self power and other power. In Japanese that's jiriki and tariki, which is or maybe familiar terms to some of you. This is from the Oxford Dictionary of World Religions. Jiriki and tariki, Japanese expressions referring to opposing methods of attaining salvation. Jiriki, or salvation through one's own efforts, and tariki, salvation depending on another power. In his teachings, the Buddha urged his followers not to look outside themselves for assistance in reaching the goal of religious life, rather they must find within themselves the will and strength needed for the task. Thus, wise disciples must themselves walk the path, with the Buddha only showing the way, shaping their own destiny and with their own karma. In Japan, the Zen school followed this tradition of jiriki. In Mahayana Buddhism, however, not totally distinct, but anyway, followers believed it was inconceivable for the Buddha, being the compassionate and loving figure that he was, to restrict the results of his meritorious karma only to himself. Rather, they contended that karma accumulated by the Buddha over countless eons could be transferred to others to assist them in their quest for salvation. This idea of the transfer of merits figured prominently in the teaching of the Pure Land School, the most popular Mahayana school in China and Japan. This school emphasized that a devotee by himself was not able to win rebirth in the Western paradise presided over by the Buddha Amitabha, Amida, but if he were to have unqualified faith in the saving grace of Amitabha and would abandon himself entirely to the power of that Buddha, then he would be able to gain rebirth in the Western paradise, no matter how sinful or depraved he might be. Hence, the expression tariki, depending on the power of Amitabha. The common illustration of these concepts is the monkey and the cat. This is really interesting. So infant monkeys cling to their mothers. Hang on the back or underneath. And so the infant monkey has to hang on. So that's self-power, jiriki. Whereas a cat, the infant cats are carried by the scruff of the neck by the mother. The mother carries the little ones. So that's tariki. So whether you hang on yourself or you're carried by your mother, then these are the two different modes. So that a way of Master Shuyun talking about this different ways of understanding, this is also a way that when you're doing the chanting and say, as we were just reciting those verses about Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, we talk about them as in a sort of, the language is very much speaking of them as external qualities. Particularly the Buddha and the Sangha, like talking about the Buddha as a teacher, as an entity, the Sangha as these enlightened beings who are the disciples of the Buddha, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. That's the those who have attained the four different stages of awakening. So it's seen, and the languaging is very much sort of the tariki form, that we are praising these external beings. The Dhamma, the description of the Dhamma is more, you can read it easily both ways as being an internal qualities or as the Buddha's teachings which lead to those. But it's one of the important things, and using these kind of devotional practices to support the wisdom element is considering them as referring to internal qualities, so that when you bow to the Buddha image, you're not just bowing to an external object, but you are bowing to the quality of wisdom. So you're laying this noggin here, the head, this sort of general generator of self-concerned impulses and thoughts and feelings. You put this one down on the floor below where the Buddha is, so it's like putting the self-concern, self-obsession below wisdom. It's like physically laying that self-concern, self-obsession down before wisdom, placing wisdom in a higher position. And so, say with the way, and we'll talk about this a bit more this afternoon when we get on to shrines and things, but in Thailand, you always, in most Buddhist countries, you always have the shrine so that it's above people's heads. You wouldn't sit higher than the Buddha. If any of you have noticed going into Thai restaurants, many of the hundreds of Thai restaurants, you'll notice that they very often have a Buddha image, but the Buddha image is way up on the wall. Have you noticed that? They have a little shrine, like often sort of 6, 8, you know, 8 or 10 feet up on the wall. The reason it's up there is so that nobody will be walking with their head above the Buddha. They don't have the Buddha sort of down on the side on a shelf where you'd be looming over him. So, you know, when you are putting that, when you're following that custom, maybe, you know, for someone who's from Asia, a Thai person would think, oh, you've got to have the Buddha in a high place. Well, why? Well, because it's polite. Well, why? But that's the symbol is that you're placing that quality of wisdom in the most revered position. So when we are bowing to the Buddha, Buddha is the one who is awake, the one who knows. So that when you're doing the chanting, if you look in the words of the chanting, rather than just thinking of those terms referring to an external Buddha as a teacher, you say you can look at them as referring to these inner qualities. When you see that the blessed one, the pure one, the perfectly enlightened one, if you think of that in terms of your own awakened mind, that is the blessed one. That awakened this awakened mind, this knowing mind, is the blessed one. It's the pure one. And the one referring to a quality rather than a person. Perfectly enlightened, impeccable in conduct and understanding, accomplished, knower of the worlds. It is that which knows the worlds. So we're bowing, we're referring to, we're reciting these qualities of our own deepest nature. And even though it uses these personal pronouns, he is teacher of gods and men, he is awake and holy, that you can just, as you chant it, sometimes I do this myself, you just replace it with an it, with a he, with an it. And you're consciously referring to those inner qualities and remembering that it's meaningful in that way. And then in the bit, one of the bits we didn't chant, the supreme praise of the Buddha, the worthy one endowed with such excellent qualities, whose being is composed of purity. So that wisdom mind, that knowing mind, is composed of purity, transcendental wisdom and compassion. So just taking a line like that and saying this, when the mind is awake, when the mind is free from self-concern, that pure awakened nature, you can say it is pure, pure, composed of purity, transcendental wisdom and compassion, has enlightened the wise like the sun awakening the lotus. I bow my head to that peaceful chief of conquerors. So it's like it's graphic language talking about external beings, but when we turn it inside, when we see the inner quality of it, that you know, every one of us who might have problems bowing to golden images say, well, I'll bow to that. that these are things that are worthy to be looked up to. These are things that are worthy of bowing to. This is something that's worthy of respect. No argument with that. These qualities of my nature are far more helpful to me and others, and so that quality of reverence and love and respect, and oh yeah, of course, you know, is much more automatic. Where we might think, well, I've got some issues about the Buddha as a teacher, and you well, it seems so remote and far away. So that's one of the themes I hope we'll kind of go into more of during the day, but I think we also need to respect our own caution about superstition and being attached to you know, ideas and beliefs, like in this is Ajahn Chah's collection of Ajahn Chah's teachings. He lambs into the tendency for Thai people to be superstitious quite vigorously in many places, but this is one of them. This is a talk called Making the Heart Good. These days people are going all over the place looking for merit, and they always seem to stop over at Wat Bapong, his monastery. If they don't stop over on their way out, they stop over on their return trip. Some people are in such a hurry I don't even get a chance to see or speak to them. most of them are looking for merit. Or people go on these sort of merit-making tours. They go in a big tour bus and they stop off at a monastery, make a bunch of offerings, bow to the shrine, whoosh, back on the bus and zoom off. So this is the kind of scene that's just happening. This Ajahn Chah has actually managed to snag a group, you know, that actually sort of stopped and saw him on the way. So this is who he's talking to. I don't see many of them looking for a way out of wrongdoing. They're so intent on getting merit, they don't know where they're going to put it. It's like trying to dye a dirty, unwashed cloth. So that he goes into saying, sooner or later, all these people looking for merit will have to start looking for a way out of wrongdoing. But not many people are interested in this. The teachings of the Buddha are so brief, but most people just pass them by, just like they pass over Wat Bapong. For most people, that's what Dhamma is, a stopover. So he would lamb it. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, very similarly, there's going to be a day later on this year, is Ajahn Buddhadasa's 100th anniversary. And the two of them really lambed into the tendency towards superstition. But also, I think it's important to recognize that superstition doesn't just involve being superstitiously bowing to shrines and making offerings and asking to get sprinkled with holy water. It can also be very superstitious with meditation practice, that if you sit and watch your breath for 20 years, then something good is going to happen. That's a superstition. What? No, that's practice. That's real practice, is me watching my breath. Oh, yeah? You know, a monitor in the hospital will watch your breath. Just plug on the electrodes and switch it on, it'll monitor your breath. It watches your breath even more flawlessly than you can. The respirator monitor, most respiration monitor, is not going to get enlightened by following the breath, right? So sometimes it's where we are superstitious can be mysterious, it can be unexpected, and so that sometimes we look at something as being, I don't do that. I'm not into devotional practice. I'm not superstitious. But then we slavishly believe that if you just keep following this ritual behavior, sitting down on a cushion and doing certain things, that some kind of benefit is intrinsically going to come just by following the behavior. That's a superstition. And I mean, it's maybe a lot more wholesome and useful than going out and doing a lot of other things. But it's important to recognize it's not intrinsic in sitting quietly. Like Ajahn Chah would say, you know, some people think that just sitting silently for hours on end is somehow going to liberate them. I've seen chickens sit on their nests for days without moving, and they're not liberated. But they can sit a long time. So just because we can sit a long time, or just because we've developed the skill of following our breath, it's don't assume that is intrinsically a liberating thing. That's as much of a superstition as carrying around an amulet that you think is going to get you through your exams or protect you from a car crash. I would humbly suggest. But it's true, you know, that sometimes people will come and say, I've been doing Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, I've been doing this for 20 years and I'm not getting anywhere. And that you realize that they've been very devoted and committed, practicing sort of morning and evening every day for 20 years, but their whole set up, the way the mind is handling, if I just do this, then I'm going to get somewhere, I'm going to get jhana, I'm going to get liberated, I just have to do this. And so the whole attitude that with which the practice is picked up is completely unrecognized. It's not being appreciated that the way you pick it up and handle it is going to have its effect. And that, you know, certainly mindfulness of breathing is a wonderful tool and incredibly helpful. But in and of itself, tracking our breath is not a liberating thing. Just as walking meditation for hours on end, or just as any other kind of, or as bowing 100,000 times. In the Tibetan Nundro training, the 100,000 prostrations, 100,000 mantras, 100,000 visualizations, and so on. That yes, we can. Develop those behaviors and follow them, and they can be helpful. You can develop a lot of good qualities doing that. But it's a superstition to believe this is intrinsically going to liberate. This is an intrinsic good contained within this. And that's the point of when we're considering letting go of superstition and getting beyond superstition, the Silapata Paramasa, one of the first three of the ten fetters, you know, along with doubt and attachment to Sakkāya-ditti, to self-view. Silapata Paramasa is not just to do with kind of golden images. It can be all kinds of other things as well, that we are not seeing, that we're assuming that they have a power or a strength or a capacity. But it's totally how we use the tool. If we use anapanasati in the mindfulness of breathing in a good way, then it certainly will liberate us. As, you know, the Buddha, this is his own method of meditation himself. But I just want to put that out, that it's not an intrinsic given, that superstition is somehow got some bells, you know, the usual bells and whistles that we think of as superstition, you know, associated with it. But we can be superstitious in other ways. As long as I keep coming along to the Sati Center events, if I study enough, if I read enough Buddhist books, I'm going to understand this. That's I'm not trying to put down the Sati Center, but you know, just that's a superstition to believe that. No, it's what you do with the books, it's how you handle the days, how you use the knowledge that you take on. That's what helps us. It's not contained within the object itself. It's entirely up to the way we employ it. So. Similarly, on the other end of the spectrum, we might say, "Well, I'm not a faith type. You know, I'm not a faith type. I like to practice meditation. You know, I can't go along with that sort of devotional stuff. You know, it's chanting and bowing. It just kind of turns me off. But you know, I'm just not a faith type." And then you say, "But you know, you go on this 3 month retreat every year." You keep silence for 3 months every year. You know, you sit still for hours on end. You do, you know, walking meditation, sitting meditation, you know, 18 hours a day. You say there's no faith involved in that? Well, no, it's not. That sounds like there's a lot of confidence and faith that this is all, you know, there's a tremendous amount of focus and energy and goodness employed there. I would say that's a tremendous faith, that this practice and doing that and spending your life year, you know, week after week, month after month, doing that, that's heavily involved with faith. Just arousing that energy every day, going to that, not doing any of the 10,000 other things that you could be doing. As a faith, that this is a precious and valuable thing for me to be doing, and I can see that's working, and not just a belief. But recognizing the good results and having faith to act on the implications of those results, so that sometimes we can be much more of a faith type than we realize. Again, because we're kind of looking at it in a superficial way, but actually we're demonstrating tremendous amount of faith and commitment, and that can really powerfully developing that side of our practice. We're just not calling it that. Like when Ajahn Chah went to IMS in 1979, and there was a retreat going on, he was there for quite a few days, and he was really impressed. He was watching, and he was a real observer. He liked to watch things, and so he was very scrupulous in the way he looked at things. And he says, "These people are—they're much more disciplined than my monks and nuns at Wat Pa Phong. I can't get my monks to sit this still. These people," and that was his comment, you know. "These people really have a lot of faith in the practice." You know, when you're sitting there, and I'm not a faith type, I'm a wisdom type, you know. But again, don't judge, we shouldn't judge ourselves too narrowly, and see that actually, yeah, we do employ that element of saddha, very, very thoroughly, when we sustain a commitment, when we keep to a practice, when we sustain our steering our lives around right view and keep on that track of cultivating Dhamma, there's an awful lot of faith involved in that. So the in the expression of what's called the five spiritual faculties, which I'm sure being ardent students of Dhamma, you're familiar with, the faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. So sati is at the middle, very appropriately for today. Mindfulness is at the middle. These are the five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers. And so they work as a team, these five. So you have sati at the center. That's the middle, like the body of the bird. That's the energy source. That's the coordinating element for them. And then you have on either side, you have virya and samadhi, energy and concentration, are the next two out. And then you have saddha and panya, faith and wisdom. So that it's often said that you have to balance, developing the faculties correctly, you have to balance concentration and energy. Too much energy and not enough concentration, and you become agitated and restless. Too much concentration and not enough energy, and then you become dull and sleepy. The mind seems very peaceful, but it's barely conscious. That kind of, it's that, why does the morning sitting go so quickly feeling? Because your forehead is on the carpet. So that's too much concentration, not enough energy. So that we might feel peaceful, we might feel focused, but it's because the range of awareness has sort of shrunk to a pinpoint. We're very alert within that pinpoint. There's only like about 1% of activity going on. So concentration and energy, samadhi and virya, need to be balanced with each other. And then with the subject in hand, this particular subject of devotion, so saddha, faith on one end, and panya on the other, they need to be balanced with each other. So too much faith and not enough wisdom, that's when we become kind of superstitious and credulous. We're easily moved by beliefs and are pulled into a kind of starry-eyed devotionalism. Too much panya and not enough saddha, not enough faith, then we become the cynic, the clever cynic that understands everything but has faith in nothing. So the mind becomes very critical and negative, and is just a very divisive. So saddha is a sort of everything's fine. Too much saddha, not enough wisdom. There's no discernment. There's no discriminating wisdom of like, well, this is useful and that's not useful. This is true, that's not true. So that those two need to balance each other. And so in this development of devotional practice, then you are deliberately, consciously developing the panya element along with the saddha. So along with invoking the emotional side and arousing the feelings of love and enthusiasm for Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then you're also using that, you're developing the panya side, so that as you are recollecting these qualities, you're also looking at the inner dimension of them. You're looking at the kind of greater context within which those qualities exist, so that there's a a kind of feeding into. There's a way that these two dimensions feed into each other, so that you're reflecting on the meaning, and then looking at the internal meaning, the internal and external aspects of the meaning, as you're chanting, as you're reciting, as these words that we recollect, or these images that we use. So when we're bowing to the Buddha, there's a bowing to wisdom, bowing to truth, and bowing to virtue, so that Sangha internally, just as Dhamma internally reflects the truth of the way things are, as well as the Buddha's teachings externally, bowing to the Sangha is bowing to that in us which is able to harmonize with other beings, that which is unselfish, in our nature, bowing to unselfishness, bowing to virtue, to a kind of abandonment of self-centeredness. And that we see that what makes these three a real refuge, a real safe place. And again, Ajahn Chah was very exceptional in saying such things as, you know, the Buddha that is a refuge is alive today. The Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, he's not a refuge because he's gone. But the Buddha which is a refuge is that awakened mind, that quality of knowing, the puru, the one who knows. That is the Buddha, which is the refuge that we can draw upon. So when we bow or we recite the three refuges, then what we're essentially doing, well, if we want to really cultivate, develop the refuges, it's looking at those qualities of our own nature, that in us which is awake, that in us which is completely in accord with nature, that which is fundamentally, radically unselfish. That's what is the refuge. If we go to those places, if that's what we make our abiding place, that's where we turn to, where we place our heart, then everything will be fine. We've taken refuge. So it's not a matter of taking refuge isn't just admiring the monastic community or the enlightened disciples or admiring the Buddha or the words of Dhamma. It's finding those qualities within ourselves. That is what provides the safe place for the heart. And it's when we apply these teachings this kind of way, we reflect on them, we apply the punya element, the wisdom element, and see, oh, that's how it works. Like, and I knew I loved this, but I didn't really know why. Oh, look, and then it comes alive, and then, oh yeah, I can really get enthusiastic about that. Oh, right. And then the devotion really comes from the heart, really, rather than just doing it because everybody else in the room is doing it, or that we have a sort of vague feelings of, yeah, right, that feels okay, that feels good. So I'll leave my exposition there for the morning. If there's maybe another question or two before we move on to the next piece of devotional practice. Yes?
Question, maybe reflection. Just in terms of really express devotion to the teacher. What it's like, this just follows what you're saying, it's about the greatest gift is not necessarily to give.
So I'm just thinking about relationship with the teacher, that really the essence is, if we could see the emptiness, the shunya, the non-self, or even just the impermanence. Like if I see you as a very impermanent being, which actually you are, but if I don't, so am I. Yes. Then I actually have greater yearning, energy, motivation, faith to attend, because this is a precious moment, right? Because there's no guarantee that the next moment I'll be here to hear, to listen, or to imbibe, or that you'll be here to fill. And that's just one perspective. And another perspective is that, again, the thing about it, having a teacher, I'm looking at you and I'm looking at, you know, one of your teachers, and just thinking the living presence, which, of course, and I think that what you just said a moment ago that came from your teacher was fantastic, that it's not Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical one, but the present, current, in this moment, living person who's embodying that. Now, I can't tell who here was or is enlightened or not, but it's actually, there's the faith that this is something wholesome. So even like to want to realize emptiness or lack of an inherent existent self is faith. Right, because I don't realize it, so I have no empirical evidence if that's helpful or not. Mm-hmm. But I believe, based on the text, historical and present, that this is something worth, that this is actually an elixir that may help alleviate some distorted parts of me. Mm-hmm. So I have to have faith, even though, yeah, so it's just reflections on the fact of what really enhances this, what is it, the representation, what's the action of actual devotion to the Buddha Dharma Sangha? Is not seeing, you know, part of it is also not seeing a separation between you and me, mm-hmm. or the Buddha and me, or the Buddha and you, or Ajahn and you. And I mean, that would be the greatest act of devotion, I think. Is that accurate?
I wouldn't say it's the greatest necessarily, but it's certainly one way of approaching it that's helpful. I wouldn't say it's wide of the mark, but one of the passages I was going to read later on today, which is where this is just before the Buddha's Parinibbana, just before he's about to pass away. So the Buddha is lying down on his robes underneath these sal trees that have just burst out into blossom, out of season. And those twin sal trees burst forth in an abundance of untimely blossoms, which fell upon the Tathagata's body, sprinkling it and covering it in homage. Divine coral tree flowers fell from the sky, divine sandalwood powder fell from the sky, sprinkling and covering the Tathagata's body in homage. Divine music and song sounded from the sky in homage to the Tathagata. And the Lord said, Ananda, these sal trees have burst forth into an abundance of untimely blossoms, etc., etc. Divine music and song abound. Divine music and song sound from the sky in homage to the Tathagata. Never before has the Tathagata been so honored, revered, esteemed, worshipped, and adored. And yet, Ananda, whatever monk or nun, male or female lay follower, dwells practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfills the Dhamma way, he or she honors the Tathagata, reveres and esteems him, and pays him the supreme homage. The supreme homage. Therefore, Ananda, we will dwell practicing the Dhamma properly and perfectly fulfill the Dhamma way. This must be your watchword. So if you really want to revere and honor and adore the Tathagata, the Buddha, then the way you do that is to practice the Dhamma. So the way you were describing, seeing things in terms of Dhamma, then that would be one instance of how a practicing the Dhamma. But any way that one is practicing the Dhamma. So, and also there's a famous teaching of the Buddha called the hem of the robe, where he says, if someone is sitting, if someone was walking behind me holding onto the hem of my robe, and yet their heart was filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, then it would be as if they're far away from the Tathagata. But even one who is living 100 leagues away, if their heart is filled with virtue, concentration, and wisdom, then it is as if they were sitting face to face with the Tathagata, and he is sitting face to face with them, even though they're physically far away. So that practicing the Dhamma, you're close to the Buddha, and that's the highest kind of reverence is not in offering all the kind of flowers and goodies, rainbows and mandarava blossoms, but in that awakening to the Dhamma in this moment. But speaking of offerings and speaking of awakening to the Dhamma in this moment, it's now 11:45. So maybe if we can just... Did I see a hand going up there? Yeah, Hugh, one more before we...
You were telling the story about the retreat with Howard Noodleman. I was thinking about, as you were telling the story about Howard Noodleman on the retreat and the painful movie, I was thinking about the 250 Protestant sects we've managed to create in the West, perhaps 300, 500 by now, I don't know. And that story that you read from The Turning of the Wheel was very encouraging about that in China they had had all of that and they had come back to one. And I was very very gratified to hear that.
Mm. And Master Xu Yun was, of the five lineages of Buddhism in China, the Chan lineage, the Sutra study lineage, the Vinaya lineage, the esoteric lineage and the mantra recitation lineage, that he was the patriarch of all five. Not because he put himself up for election. He was so revered that he actually united all, even those last remaining five strands of Buddhism in China. He brought together through his own virtue.